You know, we call them soft skills, but in practice, they're often hard to master, hard to teach, and hard to measure. We're going to talk about the world of soft skills and how we can actually make them work with ETU's Declan Dagger on this episode of the Learning Geeks podcast, starting now. Good. Our guest just gave me a thumbs up, and he's clearly using Macintosh with Microsoft Teams because I got the little animation, which is super cool. But before we bring Declan into the studio, hello, boys. How are you?
Hey, I'm doing good.
Doing well.
Doing well.
Happy it's the weekend.
As always. Yes. That's a common theme of our show.
And Bob, you just you did a race a couple of weekends ago, didn't you?
I did.
You recovered from that? A half marathon?
Yeah, I did. I did the Disneyland half marathon, and that was super fun. You know, my goal was to beat the balloon ladies. at the Run Disney races, they have a very strict, like, you know, you have to finish at a 16-minute per mile pace because they need to get you through the parks and out of the parks so they can open the parks for paying customers, mm-hmm. right? And so so they've got a very strict pace, and they've got the typical sag wagon that you have on timed races like that. But there are a few women who, on a volunteer basis, show up. They get huge bouquets of balloons, and then they run at – they get to the very, very back of the pack, and then they run at that pace. So, you know, as long as the balloon ladies don't pass you, you're good. And I never even saw the balloon lady, so that was good. But that was really fun. So we did that race a couple of weeks ago. Tomorrow, as we record this, we are doing the Gumball Rally at Disneyland. My son Harrison and I are. That is an independent race that's run by a Disney fan site. But it's a contest to see who can go on the most rides at Disneyland in one day.
Oh, wow.
So that's tomorrow's race, and I think it might wind up being more exhausting than the half marathon. It will definitely be longer. Yeah. Like, so we have to get there at 6:30 in the morning, and it goes till 6:30 at night.
Do you have a number in mind of how many rides you think you're going to get? And do you strategically look at rides that are shorter? And
you do. You do. So we're still working out our strategy. We're rookies to this, and, you know, we have kind of the pre-race party tonight, so we're going to be meeting some of the other teams. Everybody seems very friendly so far. But we'll try to get some strategies.
Competition hasn't set in yet.
Yeah. You know, I think the trick is to really avoid the rides with the long waits and try to do the ones with the short waits as much as possible. So, Jake, I might not get on Rise of the Resistance tomorrow, but I will definitely get on King Arthur's Carousel.
Oh, good. It's funny because as we're talking right now, my wife Erica has been texting me because she went to Disney World over the weekend with her sister. So this is her first time without me, because usually I'm the one controlling the app, figuring out which rides to go, skipping this, going to that. I kind of have it all down where I want to go. So she's texting me all of these things. Okay, I'm here. What should I do next? You know, I'm working today. You took off. You figure it out.
Jake, it's time to adopt a coaching attitude.
Yeah, I know. Right. I was helping.
Enable her on the joys of visiting Disney parks.
Yeah.
You know, so we have some podcasts on that, Jake, you could listen to.
I know.
We do. But hey,
Jake,
let's
why don't you introduce our guest?
Exactly. Please do.
We'll stop the Disney talk. Well, so Declan is a scientist, studied computer science, AI and education psychology at Trinity College, Dublin, where he completed his PhD in studies in 2005. He's also an entrepreneur, founded and led ETU, which is a data-driven immersive learning technology company that empowers global organizations to measure and improve workplace skills. And of course, he's a fellow learning geek, continuous learner, loves exploring new ways that around data and learning, and merging that into improve performance. So, Declan, it's great to have you on and, you know, talk this. I know we want to talk a lot about applied research. You have a lot of background within educational psychology and just great to have you on the show. Thanks and welcome.
Yeah, welcome.
Yeah, thanks, Jake. Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Dana, for having me. Delighted to be here to have the conversation today and to connect with your audience. As you said, yeah, we'll talk a little bit about sort of applied research. We'll probably delve into the world of cycling and golf along the way as we talk about nice. Some of the things that I'm starting to geek out a little bit on recently. It might be a midlife crisis thing, but hey, you got to continuously learn. So that's a part of the journey. But yeah, as you touched on there, started background and sort of career path in applied research, sort of combining computer science, engineering, AI, educational psychology, really focusing in on the area of personalized learning, which was really about obviously not only adapting the learning journey and the learning pace and the learning content towards the individual, but really taking that individual's characteristics, capabilities, attributes, and using those to mold and dynamically adjust the learning path and flow on the fly. Some really, really, interesting research, combining those sort of cross-disciplinary fields. But it was really the journey beyond that PhD research as we started to take the findings out of the lab and into the real world and apply it is where things really became exciting for me as a learning geek, as we started to look across areas that I think Bob touched on it earlier. Soft skills are typically hard to do, hard to measure. And that was an area that really jumped out at us to try and tackle early days. In one particular example, we were looking at applying the techniques and capabilities that we were developing and researching in the lab in the area of doctor-patient communication. So I'm not sure if you know a lot of doctors or have encountered a lot of doctors in your past life. But usually the ones that stand out are those ones that can communicate really good or really well and have a good bedside manner. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Or when you're thinking about opportunities to build soft skills, like, yes, that seems like a very rich opportunity.
It seems like a great place to start.
I was going to say, I have a doctor who never gets my jokes. I always try. He just doesn't laugh.
But we don't get your jokes. So. We don't laugh either. So
you at least try. He's a good doctor, but he's not a humorist.
And I think that's what we found. Interestingly enough, within that field, you obviously have highly intelligent people, very technically capable. You know, they excel at exams and performance within exams. But that sort of soft skills, the bedside manner, the patient communication, is typically an area that is underdeveloped, let's say, within the discipline, and an area that can have huge significant improvements and performance enhancement in terms of patient experience, etc., and patient outcomes. So we were really interested in focusing in that area, and we partnered with the medical school at Trinity to develop some novel techniques and technologies to apply what we were doing in the adaptive learning space to tackle this problem of sort of soft skills development and measurement within this sort of doctor-patient situation. And what we did, we sort of combined experiential learning, and I know we've had some great geeks on the podcast talking about experiential learning and the benefits of learning by doing, so we won't sort of go over that old ground. But we used experiential learning. We were able to place these trainee doctors into virtual situations where they were communicating and interacting with patients. And the thing that really got me excited or interesting was, how do we actually start trying to codify the skills that we're trying to develop in those communication mm-hmm. situations? And more importantly, how do we actually measure those sort of skills and how those skills are being demonstrated within the simulated environment? So as we continue that research forward, we essentially came up with methods to not only codify the skill, but to be able to measure it. And that experiential learning piece really gave us a catalyst to be able to do that, because experiential learning draws out, the psychological aspects that of immersion that draw people into a scenario. It also opens up the pathways within the brain for deeper learning to be able to occur and happen. So we sort of devised a technology or a method that almost flipped the traditional training method. Most training methods, and again, I wasn't a fan of school growing up. I don't know who was. Show me somebody who was. But that whole method of, we'll teach you something and then we'll assess you at the end, just seems sort of counterintuitive. So we sort of flipped that on its head and really embedded the measurement and the data within the learning process. So not only did it happen at the beginning, it also happened throughout and at the end. So that notion of almost like measure, practice, and perform created this really tight cycle that enabled the students in this particular case to be able to focus in on the skills, the soft skills that they were weaker in, and really practice those to drive their performance. But it also, importantly, it enabled them to, I suppose, divert time away from the elements or skills that they didn't need development in. So again, if you take the view that most individuals are unique and have unique perspectives and skill sets, being able to identify the gap is as important as being able to sort of remediate, you know, the issues.
So Declan, with that backstory, did that come when you were forming ETU, or was that during some of your PhD work and even before you founded ETU? Like, when did ETU come along in the journey?
Great question, Jake. So yeah, ETU started to manifest itself in terms of timeline really was after the PhD completion. And then that application of the research in like the medical discipline, that was almost like the pre-commercialization. This is a big thing within the US universities where you start to incubate the spinouts before they become spinouts.
Yeah.
So that was like in the incubation phase. So that was like, look, we've got some methods here. You know, we've tested them in a closed environment in the lab. Let's actually start pushing this out into the real world to see if it can actually work, to see if it can scale, to see if we can replicate those results that we saw in the lab. So in a sense, Jake, what we're talking about here was the foundation and the background intellectual property that became ETU.
As Jake was introducing you, part of that introduction included the idea of being data-driven. And I'm wondering if you can elaborate a little bit on that. How do you find the right data, and then how do you leverage that in order to make a personalized experience?
Yeah, that's a great question. So I think I sort of mentioned at the start of the conversation, as you said, is that data within the learning process. So as we had built, let's say, the method and the technology to be able to deliver this experiential learning with those cycles of measure, practice, perform, and sort of embedded within it, we really sort of shifted our focus onto the data element. So codifying the skills is one element. And that sort of comes from sort of the computer science and knowledge engineering background. So it's sort of semantic webs. So the idea that you're able to semantically codify and connect the various different characteristics or attributes that make up the skills that you're trying to develop. And then the fact that you're able to then encode them within the simulated experience gives you the ability to be able to measure against that and track performance. And as you're able to then track the performance of the learner throughout that experience, you're able to then say, oh, you know, you're showing that you're not performing so well over here. So let's do a little bit more practice over here to get better at that. Where over here you're demonstrating, oh, you're doing really well here. So let's not focus our attention there. And, you know, there's great value in that for a learner as part of the learning experience, but also as for an organization in the broader perspective, because it enables the organization to be able to do two really important things, is to be able to determine what actually needs to be trained, but also what doesn't need to be trained. You know, so I think a lot of the time we take, I don't want to say we undervalue time, but obviously time is an incredibly valuable resource for everybody, employees, learners, whoever. But being able to deploy that time in the most optimal way, we found that personalized learning, and particularly having data within the learning cycles, enables you to do that in a more optimized way. So I can give you some examples of that if you'd like.
Yeah, that would be great. I really like the idea of taking a skill and breaking it down into something that, you know, you can codify, because I think often we'll say, you know, communication skills. Well, what does that mean? Right. I mean, that's such a broad
or storytelling, term. Right? Like,
or storytelling. Multiple yeah, there's, things. There's all it. Kinds of them. And if you don't break it down, how can you get to the data? So I really like the way that you talked about that. Yeah. Do you have some examples?
Yeah. And just even a little bit further on that, Dane, as well, I think with the semantic web sort of background as well, when you think of actually defining the skill, it's also very relevant that you have to define the context. So as you said, communication is very, very broad, right? But even if you take a skill of, let's just say, active listening, for example. So active listening is a skill, but that can show up and an individual person can show up levels of that skill differently based on the context. You know, so if you're in a conversation that you really, really enjoy and engage with the topic, you're more likely to demonstrate a high proficiency of active listening, where if you're in something where you might be distracted or something that you're not so interested in. So really it's skill and context is also very important when you're thinking about the data question and the measurement question. But to give some examples of that, in sort of corporate learning environment, we were doing some work with an organization that was looking at onboarding new hires. And they had a very well-defined program that didn't have experiential learning or this data-driven learning piece within the process. It was a little bit more traditional. So you'd have your program, you would have your assessment at the end of the program. Folks would all do well in the assessment, and then they would, you know, be deployed into the workforce. But what we were noticing is that there was issues of sort of non-compliance, let's say behavioral issues, post-onboarding program. And initially the response was, oh, well, we probably need to train more on topic X or topic Y. But the reality, when we actually created the simulations and put them into the simulations and had the skill in context being measured, we were very quickly able to determine that it wasn't X or Y, it was actually Z or Z. Mm. And the Z issue was actually nothing got to do with the topic, nothing got to do with anything that was actually being trained in the onboarding. It was how to manage customer interaction and customer engagement. So what was happening in the front lines when you were deployed, because part of the values of the business was about putting the customer first, when the customer asked you to do something, inherently you would say, yes, I will do that. Even though by saying yes, you were actually putting yourself in a non-compliant context or situation. So what enabled that organization to be able to do was to focus on what the actual gap was. So instead of delivering more training on the regulatory requirements, it was actually, here's how to say no. Or here's how to say no in a constructive way.
Right. Yeah. Here's how to avoid the trap instead of how to get out of it.
Yeah.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. Another example, a more recent one in a diversity, equity and inclusion context was we were engaging with an organization looking at, let's say, some opportunities for improvement around team performance. And one of the areas that they wanted to focus on was unconscious bias training. And again, we would typically ask a question, do you have some data that supports the hypothesis that unconscious bias is the skills gap that we need to be actually targeting here? So we went on a little journey where we deployed some microsims within their organization, and very quickly we were able to find out that unconscious bias wasn't actually an issue. So people could spot it very quickly, they could call it out very quickly, but they didn't know how to deal with the fallout or the aftermath of it. So how do we build allyship within a team that has experienced something like this? Mm. How do we build skills around developing inclusive teams and diverse teams? So again, it's about using that data within the learning process, not only as an individual learner to be able to hone where you should focus your time and energy, but also as an organization, where the true gaps are that are actually holding back performance.
So this is hitting a little close to home to me, given recent events. So let me ask you for some advice here to get your story out of this. Is how do you sell that idea, right? So, you know, how do you sell it to your customers? For us in an internal learning organization, it's selling it to stakeholders. But, you know, just like the idea of, hey, instead of measuring people at the end, let's measure them at the beginning and figure out where there are gaps and assess them all the way along and assess them at the end. We might pitch that. It makes so much sense that nobody does it. And, you know, we pitch that to our stakeholders and they're like, yeah, that's all very interesting. But no, I really, really want a 2-hour webinar driven by PowerPoint where I tell them everything. You know, how do you get that idea across to your customers, Declan?
Yeah, great question, Bob. For many years, this is another learning inflection point. For many years, we would talk about the value. We would talk about the research underpinning why you would do this. All the really good stuff, right? Ultimately, it comes down to a business case. So we really find that presenting the business case is what just gets the stakeholder or the customer to say, ah, actually, you've got a fair point here. You know, if you're talking about we want to deliver a 2-hour webinar to 1,000 people, you know, that's 2,000 hours of non-production, right, that you're taking them off doing their actual job. So you want to be damn sure that that's actually delivering value. So you run a quick business case around that and you present that back to the stakeholders and say, is that really what you want to invest your time, our employees' time, our learners' time in, when you can't really determine whether that's going to yield a result for you? And most of the time, they fairly quickly turn around and say, oh, yeah, okay, I see that. Particularly as we see, you know, learning becoming way more higher order in terms of the value chain within organizations. Mm-hmm. You know, as you're sitting around the business table, where, you know, learning becomes a conversation not only about, you know, seat time and completions anymore. It's really about performance improvements. It's about how are you impacting top line? How are you reducing bottom line? The business case can really help.
So Declan, you mentioned quick sims or just really fast sims that you will run while you're doing this data gathering. Because I found that pretty interesting because, Bob, I had this similar question. Of that beginning stage is always, I think, one of the more scary times when someone's, hey, let's break down or deconstruct a soft skill, because the easy path is typically, let's just do a webinar or whatever the case could be.
Yeah.
So when you get, let's say, a quick business case to at least get them to buy in, does that also include like running these fast sims, or is that, okay, and at least we got them, now we can run some fast sims to at least gather more data in terms of what that deconstruction of that skill would look like?
Exactly, Jake. And it also changes the conversation from being a sort of a moment in time solution to being an iterative process. So again, if you are truly trying to develop skill, right, it's not a one and done. It's not a singular event. It's a process, and individuals will some individuals will go quicker, some will go slower. So as part of that business case, yes, the micro sim piece is the measurement can be included into that, but you're also communicating that this is it's a process, it's a journey that you're going to go on to increase performance.
And you have these micro sims also give you more and more fuel to that business case as well.
100%. Yeah. 100%.
I mean, I know the three of us, when we did work all together at one point, we used to use that tactic all the time where we would get little snippets of video and feedback and input and just tell that story as we go in small increments. And then throughout time, they're like, okay, we get it. We're getting it. There's more and more buy-in. So it's a really good tactic with the micro sim idea.
Exactly, Jake. And as you said, as you're going through the cycles, because there is always objective performance related data throughout the cycles, you can always go back and say, well, actually, guess what? Do you know the way we were going down this path, like in those two examples we gave, that's actually the wrong path. So we need to stop investing time and energy in that. And we need to go over here because that's actually truly what's going to change the frontline behaviors or increase the performance that we're actually looking to try and achieve.
Which I can imagine that is also a fun conversation when you get to a point when I can imagine even when you do some of those micro sims, how does that conversation, like when you realize that maybe even the direction you were testing didn't fully pan out and you yourself have to change? Because that's another thing. Even though at the beginning you got their business case, you run a couple tests, then it doesn't work out. How do you manage that? We're asking all this because we have to deal with this all the time. So it's really great feedback just to learn from.
well, part of it is how the business case is constructed, right, and positioned. So it is particularly if the organization... If the organization turns around and says, look, we've got objective data from the front lines of the business and the performance gap is here because we can actually see that there's these skills. And like that does exist in some disciplines. I mean, you would have that level of sort of live performance data in contact centers. A lot of organizations would have it or aspire to have it around, let's say, the sales engine part of the business. But in the softer areas of the business, those types of data points don't exist. So part of that cycle is about really getting data onto the conversation table when we're talking about learning, and saying that, you know, even though you might hit a dead end or a roadblock in hypothesis A, even that progress is progression towards the endpoint. So again, you know, when you stand back, it looks like a straight line, but when you actually zoom in, there is some,
it's up and down.
If we shift away from the business case and to the learner experience or the person who's achieving the skills, you're big on immersion. So I'm wondering, what type of data do you gather in order to ensure that immersion is taking place and that it's actually having the impact that you hope that it has?
So we use immersion probably more as a catalyst or a mechanism to open up the objective of either learning or measurement or both. So for us, mm-hmm. immersion is not the primary focus. There has to be a level of immersion that makes it realistic, that makes it obviously challenging, that makes it relevant to the learner within the particular job role. But it's not about creating the most realistic environment. Because again, even going back to some of the early research, there was some great work done around a thing called the fidelity curve, which sort of it indicates that you get to a point of fidelity or realism, or immersion, let's say, for example, that beyond which the investment in getting it more accurate or more realistic doesn't actually yield any extra value.
Doesn't pay off.
Exactly. Doesn't pay off. Yeah. It doesn't pay off. So there's always that balancing act. And again, this is where, to be honest, and I know we won't delve too much into Gen AI, but this is where Gen AI is obviously adding a lot of value. We've been using this for the last number of years, particularly in our production side of the sim business. So when we're talking about developing scenarios, developing media content that create that immersive experience for the learner, you know, the use of synthetic characters, the use of sort of deepfake technologies to be able to create programmable people, for want of a better word. I actually don't like that term, but it's sort of it's relatively fitting. You know,
given that Elon Musk has just embedded the chip, I think that programmable people might be more realistic.
It's getting closer. It's scary. But yeah, no, it is a good question. It is a very good question. But even in the early days of our research, if I sort of rewind the clock back sort of 15 years or so, when we were deploying the technologies in that medical field and doing our initial sort of real world tests, what we found was in the initial studies, the folks there, the psychometricians and the statisticians that were looking at the data were like, oh, this doesn't look right. This learning experience is causing, you know, high levels of cognitive workload and anxiety and stress within the learners. That shouldn't really be happening. But when we actually spoke to the participants and the trainee doctors, it was like, oh, no, that's exactly when we're going in and we're interviewing a patient or we're having to have a conversation breaking bad news about, you know, a diagnostic result that's not going to be pleasant. They feel anxious. They feel nervous. They don't want to say the wrong thing. They don't want to sort of they want to create a good patient experience. So that level of stress and anxiety is very realistic. So again, immersion can be a visual thing, but it can also be a psychological or a physiological sort of response to the environment that you're interacting with.
That is interesting. And I was thinking about the learning experience too, and kind of putting dots together in my mind. Like my expectation is if you're talking about a softer skill, those are typically things that people feel like they should just naturally be able to do well. Maybe I'm wrong about that. Maybe that's just me, right? But like typically things that people feel like they should just be able to do well.
I think we talk to them like that for sure. I think the way that it is discussed, it's like, well, we should be able to do that.
Yeah. Right. You should be able to tell a story or have a good conversation with somebody or, you know, have empathy. And you're using a learning approach.
Have empathy and have it now.
Right? Exactly. Feel
turn
what
on
I
your
feel.
Empathy meter.
But you're using a learning approach where you're measuring people to find out where their weak spots are, and then you're concentrating on the weak spots. Then you're putting them into immersive simulations. I'm imagining that you have a lot of your learners who will have experiences where they fail at something that they feel like they should naturally be good at. And so now you kind of have to deal with that affect as you're bringing them through and giving them the feedback and moving them along. So what's your strategy for making that happen and making that clean and happy?
A great question. And a lot of it sort of leans itself back to sort of performance coaching and even sort of sports coaching. So exactly to your point, a lot of folks will approach the softer skills with a unconscious incompetence perspective potentially. So they think they're really good at it.
They don't know what they can't do.
But they don't know what they can't do. And by engaging within the simulation and using feedback techniques, using coaching techniques, using those little triggers that happen within the simulated experience are ways of actually saying, ooh, you know, well, that was okay, but it could have been better. So, you know, if you try this as an approach, you are more likely to yield a better outcome, a better result. So in a sense, it's never really black and white to say, oh, you're bad at this and you're good at this. It's more subtle along that continuum or the spectrum of what we tend to call it is optimal versus suboptimal. So the idea is that you might be bad at something, but you never say you're bad. It's just like that was suboptimal, right? So there's ways and means of improving that. So let's try and slide you along the scales from suboptimal to optimal.
You know, Declan, too, I'm just looking at the clock, so I know we're running short on time here, but I'm really curious, somewhat similar to this, when you think about assessments and through simulations, because really when you're doing these types of simulations, you are getting assessed about how well your performance is. How do you make sure that it feels like it's formative? It is not necessarily, it could be evaluative, don't get me wrong. Again, depending on the field, I can imagine, of course, if you're a doctor, you definitely want to be evaluative because there's life and death that actually is involved in that if you're bad at your job. But at the same time, when we think of just formative-based assessments, so using it in a way to help you figure out where you are today and how you move forward, that can come in we hope it's a positive thing when you take those types of assessments. But still to this day, we're very triggered to think of assessments as evaluative and someone's going to see my scores or someone sees see my data and immediately is going to impact how you see me. How do you deal with that with some of the learners and as well as even the, like your clients too that you work with? I'm just curious.
Yeah, it's a great question. And the answers and the positioning of those possibilities and results manifest as well around the business case and the positioning initially within the context of, let's say you're having the conversation with the C-suite. Typically the positioning, it's not, as you said, an evaluative assessment where you're going to hire, fire or promote somebody based on the performance. You're really positioning it as a developmental tool. And so when you come down a layer, let's say, and you're looking at the positioning within an individual or for a learner or a learner population, it's really about talking to, you know, let's say some of the, for want of a better word, some of the aspects or characteristics that they place value on. So time being one of them. So by doing this iterative cycle, not only are you going to be able to, you know, reach the optimal performance or the optimal skill level, but you're going to be able to do it far quicker than other methods, right? So we will give you back more time. It's also, when you look at program and program rollout and program delivery, it's a key part of, like, say, the marketing or PR message around how it's launched. So it's been very clear up front to say, look, this is not about determining, you know, career path and trajectory. This is really being done as an effort by the organization to try and help you develop your skills and become a better role X, role Y, better person, you know, better employee, better lifelong learner.
Yeah, I could see that messaging coming in multiple channels as well.
Exactly. It's not just singular. Exactly. You approach it from multiple different angles. Yeah.
Before we wrap things up, we just need to give a nod to Declan for stepping away from the rugby game that's going on. I did just call up the score.
Don't say it.
I don't want to reveal anything. I don't want to reveal anything, but you know, I hope you enjoy the game. We'll leave it. So thank you for taking time away. It's late
so
your
much.
Night. And,
absolute
yeah.
pleasure.
Really appreciate it.
Absolute pleasure. Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on. Yeah. I really enjoyed the conversation.
Time definitely flew. Declan, if our listeners want to get a hold of you or look you up on the internets, where would they look?
Best place is jump on LinkedIn, get me on there, shoot you a message. Yeah, would love to connect with anyone that wants to go a bit deeper in conversations. And we didn't get to touch on some of the sport angles, the golf and cycling piece, but we might have to go back and do another conversation on that.
We know it's there. So search for Declan Dagger, spelled just like it sounds. you'll be good to go. Declan, thanks again for joining us. It was great to spend some time.
Thanks for joining.
Thanks, Bob. Thanks, Jake. Thanks, Dana.
And Jake Appreciate it. As always, thank you. Always a pleasure to be with you. And to our listeners, thank you for listening and hope you got a lot out of this. Make sure you hit like and subscribe. Tell all your friends. We'd love to have more friends as part of the Learning Geeks podcast. And until the next one, stay geeky, my friends. We'll see you soon. Bye.
Thanks, everybody.